This is episode 54 of the Fifth Estate Podcast, Ben Shapiro and the debate over political rhetoric.
Hey there, Jay.
Hey, Neil.
Wanted to talk to you today about our friends at Blue Apron.
Oh, I love our friends at Blue Apron.
I know. Did you know they're the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country?
Yes, I did. And did you know that their mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone?
Of course I knew that. I also know they achieve this by supporting a more sustainable food system and setting the highest standards for ingredients. This helps them build a community of home chefs.
It's great. And here's one of the great things about it is affordable. For less than $10 per person per meal, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals.
And it's easy. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow, translation, idiot-proof recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients that can be prepared in 40 minutes or less.
Yep. And here's some of the upcoming meals. That's what's so great. Warm smoked trout and asparagus salad with fingerling potatoes and garlic croutons.
There's also spiced zucchini enchiladas with creamy lime and tomato rice.
Elote-style vegetable tostadas with summer squash, poblano peppers, and cilantro rice.
Peach honey glazed chicken with mashed sweet potatoes, collard greens, and Thai basil.
Nice. So check out this week's menu and get this. You get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/fifth.
You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/fifth.
All right. It's time for another episode of the Fifth Estate Podcast. My name is Jay Caruso. I'm here with my co-host, Mr. Neil Dewing. How are you?
Jay, I'm my usual chipper self. How are you?
I'm doing quite well. Doing quite well. Hey, you know, we've hit a milestone for this podcast.
Have.
We have. The two milestones, as a matter of fact, that I think we should be pretty happy about.
Tell me what they are.
We went over 10,000 subscribers to this show, which is great news.
That is. Hot damn.
Yeah. We did that. And also, you know, you know how we implore people to go out to iTunes and leave us ratings and all that good stuff?
I'm intimately familiar with them.
we've hit triple digits on ratings as well, and 5-star ratings. You believe that?
You know what? I can believe it because, Jay, gosh darn it, we do good work. And I am gratified to see that the people out there, the listeners, appreciate it.
Certainly
we
do.
We do it for them.
Absolutely. So, again, we still are asking you to go out there, subscribe to our podcast, tell your friends to subscribe, and leave us ratings on iTunes. We really appreciate it. Okay, so kind of stepping back from the good news, it's been, you know, been a kind of a dark era in D.C. for the last week or so, when a gunman opened fire at a baseball practice, and Republicans were there practicing, and Representative Steve Scalise was shot, and several other people were shot, including a congressional aide. And the good news is now Representative Scalise is now listed in fair condition. He was critical, went to serious. He's now in fair condition. So that's good news.
That is good news. And details are, of course, still emerging about the background of this gunman. But the initial reports would seem to indicate that he was in some way politically motivated.
Yes.
Although... we would hasten to add, it's probably a little bit hasty to say he was entirely politically motivated.
Right. I mean, they don't know all the details yet of his background, but he was very politically active, started in the Occupy Wall Street movement, was a strong Bernie supporter, didn't like Donald Trump. So the environment, obviously the political environment came around to this discussion about political rhetoric and if there's any danger to it and how offensive it can be. And our
I imagine, Jay, that it was a reasoned and, cordial discussion that was had.
Sure it was. Our guest tonight certainly was one who has been on the receiving end of some of the ugliest rhetoric during the 2016 election that I can imagine. And he's obviously got some things to say about this, and we're happy to have him here. Editor in chief, Ben?
I'm the editor in chief.
Editor in chief of the Daily Wire, Ben Shapiro, is here with us. Thank you for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
All right. So, Ben, you heard what we were talking about, and then you heard about, obviously you know about the shooting. You've kind of said some stuff. You've opined about it. But before we get into anything, kind of give us your background for some people. I mean, I'm pretty sure most of our listeners know who you are, but you might as well go ahead and give us that background, and then we'll kind of go into it.
Sure. So I'm editor-in-chief of Daily Wire. I'm the host of the aptly named Ben Shapiro Show podcast. And I did sort of give a brief history of my career. I started off at UCLA. I went to Harvard Law School. I was the youngest syndicated columnist in the country at the age of 17. I have several best-selling books. One was a New York Times bestseller. I called Bullies, Have Left Culture of Fear and Intimidation Silences Americans. I worked for Breitbart as editor-at-large for about 4 years before I quit in the middle of last year in the midst of Michelle Fields' incident. I was the founder of Truth Revolt, which was a media watchdog, working with David Horowitz's Freedom Center. So it's a checkered past, for sure.
Yeah, it sounds terrible. So Ben, I mean, let's talk a little bit about the 2016 election, talking about political rhetoric. I mean, there were a couple times, and I saw this, I mean, because I follow you on Twitter, and I saw the things, and if I remember telling people, like, if Ben Shapiro ever retweets you during the midst of this election, you're automatically going to have just a bunch of trolls that are going to be jumping in saying really ugly things. I mean, you are Jewish, and so, I mean, there was just some real nastiness directed your way. And how did you kind of deal with that?
Well, I mean, I dealt with it by essentially ignoring as much of it as I could. I retweeted some of it because that was sort of Andrew Breitbart's old strategy, and it seemed to be effective. There's not much you can do about it. I was hit with an enormous wave of anti-Semitic crap from the alt-right, particularly. The ADL ranked the top journalistic recipients of anti-Semitism on Twitter in 2016. I was number one with a bullet. I mean, I was number one. I had 40% of all anti-Semitic tweets on the internet directed at journalists were directed at me. So I was the most hated Jew in America, which is a real, achievement, I think. It was a confluence of a couple of different things. One, I'm Jewish. The alt-right ain't fond of Jews. Two, I'm very, very conservative, but I was not a Trump supporter, and I would call him out when I thought he was doing things that were wrong, including a lot of the things that he was saying that I thought were plain immoral in many cases. And number three, I worked for Breitbart, which was a place that had become alt-right friendly and was obviously a Trump-supporting website. And when I quit that site, that was considered a betrayal of Trump, Breitbart, and the entire kind of fringe right. So that's why I think there was such a turn on me. It wasn't just they don't like me because of my viewpoint. It's that I had been working with people who they liked, and they didn't like that I had quote unquote betrayed them, even though I didn't really change anything I had ever said. I think that the environment around me changed a fair bit.
It's the tribal politics, right, Ben? I mean, you were a member of the tribe in good standing, and then suddenly you were disagreeing with prominent members, and so you had to be expelled.
Well, the tribalism in American politics is, to me, the greatest threat to American politics right now. It's occurring on both sides. Everybody's ensconced in the narrative that they want to believe. They're not interested in getting outside themselves enough to even make any sort of fair-minded, forget objective, because I don't think anyone's truly objective, but even to try and make a fair-minded analysis of the situation. And so that's how you end up with 42% of Republicans saying it's okay for a congressional candidate to body slam a reporter. And that's how you end up with a lot of the left saying it's okay to shut down college speeches. It's getting very ugly out there, and it seems to me less about principle, even you know, let's get rid of civility in favor of principle, it seems to me there's very little talk about even political principle, let alone moral principle. The math sort of went, get rid of the moral principle so we can achieve the political principle, and then it turns out that no political principle was actually being achieved other than the other side feeling pain. And if that's your only political principle, that's not a principle, that's just tribalism.
Right. Did it ever get to a point where you were subject to any of this offline, like in real life? Were there threats to you? I know there were some people.
Well, I mean, there were calls to my phone. Mm-hmm. There was mail sent to my house. All the kind of horrifying mailers that you see sent to people like Eric Erickson, a lot of those ended up in my mailbox. You know, we have, thank God, a really good security system since I've been relatively high profile for a while. So I have a very, very good security system and a shotgun, and that's about as much as you can do. So that was, again, my main thing was just ignoring as much of it as possible and keeping my wife away from it because, you know, she's not part of this. And there's a reason I don't post. I have two adorable children under the age of 4. I never post pictures of them online specifically because of this stuff, because I have real safety concerns.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about the media reaction to this. One of the things, and I think you probably saw it, was the New York Times did an editorial where they talked about the shooting of Steve Scalise and the others, and they brought up the Gabby Giffords shooting from 2011. And I mean, not only did they bring it up, but they said something to the effect that, you know, the shooting of the congressional baseball practice didn't have as much of a direct link as the Gifford shooting did. And there was no link. I mean, if everybody remembers their history here, just goes back a few years. I mean, Jared Loughner did not shoot Gabby Giffords because of political reasons. He was a paranoid schizophrenic, and he was obsessed with her over a question that she didn't answer when he asked her, and he became obsessed in that regard. There was nothing to do with politics. But why do you think the media decided, let's trot this out as a way of, you know, why did they even bring it up?
I mean, I think they brought it up as the whataboutism that they accused the right of engaging in with regard to Trump. They were engaging in here, right? And it was the basic idea that, you know, we don't want you to link leftist rhetoric. We don't want you to link Bernie Sanders or leftism in general with this guy. So we'll talk about what you guys did and how you really started it. And it was really about Sarah Palin. And of course, that was complete bunk. I mean, it was made up. It was vicious. There is significantly more evidence that this guy was political than Jared Loughner, who was worried apparently government being in charge of grammar and whether the sky was orange because he's an actual schizophrenic. But it's so disturbing to see people on the left, you know, their tribal politics is being exacerbated day by day. I think it started with this whole intersectional hierarchy of victimhood that they've now crafted into a coalition for political purposes. And it's extended out to the New York Times engaging in tribal politics by just completely rewriting the news, which of course grants credibility to President Trump and a lot of his supporters saying that the New York Times is fake news, which grants them the ability to ignore news that they don't like because it came from the same outlet. And then they build an entirely new news narrative that's built on something completely fictitious on their own side. So it's this sort of self-perpetuating cycle that begins, I think, with the left, and then the right responds. And so you have basically reactionaries just reacting to each other ad infinitum. And nowhere in here does anyone say, hey, what about, you know, basic principles like liberty and freedom? What about basic principles like freedom of speech and adherence to facts? All these things just go completely out the window because, hey, all that matters is that we nail Sarah Palin because the last thing we want is for Bernie Sanders to get in trouble.
Right. And it's disturbing in that sense because the New York Times has done some great reporting, you know, since Donald Trump has been president. A lot of their, you know, some stuff was, you know, I mean, there's been, let's face it, the media has made mistakes, but they've also done some good reporting. But yeah, when they write an editorial like that, basically they're just, like you said, they're giving reason for people to sit there and say, okay, the New York Times is fake news and we don't have to believe anything. Now, in fairness, there have been some Republican quarters. I wouldn't say more in the mainstream, but probably more online, in, you know, the Twitter world and the social media world, who have taken advantage of the fact that, you know, this guy was a, you know, the shooter, the Scalise shooter was kind of a Bernie bro, to, you know, like you said, to be able to sit there and blame Democrats for, you know, this kind of shooting. I think somebody made a good point. I don't remember who it was. They said, look, it's and let me see if you agree with this. Yes, the shooter is solely responsible for what he did, but the political climate in which we're in would allow him to feel good about what he did.
Yeah, I think there's truth to that. Look, words do matter, but I want to say two things. Words matter, but words are not violence. And I think that people have failed to make that connection both ways. So there are people who will say, words are not violence, therefore words don't matter at all, right? I can say whatever I want without fear of consequence and without fear that it's going to spur anyone to not only action, but to think bad things. This is sort of the Milo Yiannopoulos view of free speech, that all words are the same. It's almost a leftist deconstructionist view. Language doesn't matter. What I say doesn't matter. All that matters is that I'm free to say it. And that is not correct. And then on the other side, you have people who say words matter. And not only do words matter, words are violence. And that's the people who try and shut down Milo Yiannopoulos at UC Berkeley because his words are equivalent to violence. We can acknowledge both things at the same time. One is that words are not violence, which is why we have a First Amendment in this country. And the second thing is that words matter, and so we should probably be responsible about how we use them. And that, I think, is that last one is more controversial among conservatives, although I think both are now becoming controversial among conservatives. I mean, when you have Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham approving of people running up on stage in the middle of Julius Caesar to try and shut down a play because they don't like the words that are being said, I mean, that's just the same sort of snowflakery that you see on the left. But I think that the broader, you know, concern from the right seems to be that they want to say, and I have a tendency toward this to myself, is to downplay the impact of words and say, well, words don't matter at all, and so you can say whatever you want, and it's not a big deal, except words clearly do matter, and they do have an impact. Now, I don't like using outliers like this guy who shot up Congress as an example of that, because my tendency is to believe that words tend to matter to broad movements. Just doing the math, if there's, you know, if there's 1,000 nuts in the country, and there's an additional 500 nuts who might be activated by inflammatory rhetoric that isn't actively promoting violence, I don't know that you bear very much moral culpability for that. I mean, when you act on the, I don't like making broad moral rules about what happens on the fringes. I'd be more concerned with the fact that the left seems to be very much approving of the anti-free speech movement on campus. That seems to be like an actual mainstream thing that's happening on the left. I don't know anybody on the left who looked at this guy who's shooting everybody else, except for maybe Joy Reid, and thinking, oh, this is a good thing. So I do think that's a distinction worth making.
Ben, do you think that the role of government in our lives and its sort of its intrusion into more and more aspects of our daily lives, do you think that has a role to play in the increased tribalism and the failure of people to listen to one another and actually debate these issues? You know, is it a correct perception that, you know, when you take hold of the reins of power, you can really change things for the better or for the worse? And so consequently, you know, we have to oppose everything, you know, to the nth degree. And there's all this Sturm und Drang on, you know, on social media. Do you think that the expanded role of government has something to do with that?
I do. I really do. I mean, I basically wrote about that for National Review this week. I think a lot of the apocalyptic rhetoric that you see from both sides is a direct result of the massive growth in government. If William Henry Harrison got elected in 1840 and you didn't get, and you weren't happy with it, fortunate news for you, you didn't really have to care since the federal government didn't do anything. When the federal government is involved in every aspect of your life, then you tend to get the rhetoric from the right that if Hillary Clinton becomes president, the world will literally end. Everyone will literally die. And then if Donald Trump is elected president, you get the exact same rhetoric, except directed from the left. He's going to pull out of a meaningless thing like the Paris Agreement, and we're all going to boil to death in the global warming heat. If the federal government didn't matter, we would not have to care who was elected president. It would be like who argues over their local DMV head? No one cares. They're an administrator. But the president has become such an overweeningly powerful position thanks to the growth of the federal government and the abdication of the legislature that what you end up with is people feeling like this really is a matter of life or death. And once you feel that, you know, President Trump is a Nazi who's going to get tons of people killed and boil the earth, then you will get more people who are willing to do extreme things to stop that. And the same thing on the right. And it's super dangerous. My critique has largely been on the right because I'm on the right. And so it's been disturbing to me how many members of the right are willing to overthrow basic Judeo-Christian senses of morality because they want what they want, because in a time of war, all is justified. But the left's been doing that for 30 years. I mean, basically, as long as I've been alive, the left has been doing that.
Well, and, you know, it's this idea, if you really believe that Donald Trump is going to destroy the planet or that Hillary Clinton is going to mortgage your future and make you a virtual slave or what have you, I don't even know what the critique there is. But if you really believe those things, and if you are adamant that these are the stakes, in a perverse way, logically, aren't you required to commit acts of violence in that framework?
That's right. I think that's right. Everybody who keeps talking about a civil war, and then they say, well, it's just a cultural civil war. My friend Dennis Prager uses this language all the time. We're in a cultural civil war. And I don't mean a literal civil war. I just mean a cultural civil war. Okay, well, then we have to define what tactics are on the table and which ones aren't. Because what I'm seeing is that in the last year alone, Republicans who used to abhor all this stuff are now saying it's okay to charge on stage a Julius Caesar play. They're saying it's okay to say that you're going to pay for the legal bills of people who punch protesters. They're saying it's okay to body slam reporters. They're approving of all this behavior that 3 years ago they never would have approved of because, hey, in a war, this is what you have to do. And so my feeling is, well, if you're going to suggest that we're in a war, then we at least need to set the ground rules of the war, as long as you're not talking about a war. Because if you're talking about a war, and now you're saying it's an actual war, right? Politics is just actual war by other means. Then the question is, why isn't it just war by other means? I mean, if you really believe that the future of the country is so deeply at stake that if the Democrats get elected to an additional seat in Georgia, that your freedom will be gone and the United States as we know it will be over, then I don't understand why you're not morally obligated to pick up a gun. I don't believe that. I think politics is deeply important. That's why I spend my life doing it. But I think that the American people are convincible. I think we live in a democratic republic in which you have to have some faith in the people. Otherwise, just call for a martial dictatorship that establishes your views from the top.
Well, and when you have this highly charged rhetoric, nonstop, it actually erodes the real arguments that you're trying to make, such as, say, the election of Donald Trump will erode our cultural norms or our political norms in a fundamental way that we may not be able to quickly recover from, which is happening. And so that argument has less credibility because it's a little bit ho-hum, you know?
Yeah, that's right. I think that's right. When you make a subtle argument about why you think Trump did something wrong, then your own side will say to you, well, we're in an existential war. What are you worried about, these principles, right, this routine? And then on the left, it's the same thing. If you say something like, well, Trump doesn't appear to be very good at his job. He's in over his head and he's kind of corrupt. Then people on the left go, wait a second. We're the resistance, guys. I mean, Donald Trump's a threat to our way of life. Donald Trump is going to kill our children. Donald Trump is evil. He's Hitler. Once you get to this point, I'm less worried about these sporadic acts of violence than I am about an active growing movement of people who think that violence is okay.
Yeah. And so, but let's also look at this from, and I think it's funny because there's a difference because people are talking about, historical things that politicians have said. And I think it's different because if you look back in history, politics got ugly, but it was much more personal. So, if you go back to 1800 when Thomas Jefferson said about President Adams, he's a hideous, hermaphroditical character which has neither the force and firmness of a man nor the gentleness and sensibility of a woman. And then Adams' retort was that Jefferson is a mean-spirited, low-lived fellow, the son of a half-breed Indian squaw, sired by a Virginia mulatto father. Now, I don't think you would say any politicians say that about each other these days. I mean, the most you've seen is, Donald Trump say, she's, crooked Hillary, or Donald Trump is, unfit for office. But when you put that aside, when you put that up against what you were talking about, you and Neil were just talking about, that the doom and gloom, it's not become Donald Trump is an ass or Hillary Clinton is an ass. It's if you elect this person, the world is going to end. And I think that has deeper implications than some of the good zingers that politicians used to get off about each other in years past.
Yeah, I think that's true. Jake Haast was tweeting about this. I know he had a kind of a Twitter fight with John Podhoretz over this. And I had sympathy for both sides because, along with Jay, I inflammatory political rhetoric doesn't tend to bother me all that much. I mean, if you've ever watched any of my videos, you can tell. But by the same token, I do think that we're living in a slightly different environment, as John says, with regard to the ubiquity of viewing of these sorts of things. So it used to be that, okay, so John Adams said something in his diary about Jefferson, and Jefferson said something in his muckraking papers about Adams. But the circulation of these things was like 11 people. So there's that. It's also worth noting that, historically speaking, there have been plenty of violent incidents in the United States. I mean, the level of baseline violence in the United States up to the Civil War was actually a lot higher than it is now, or even in the 1960s.
Right.
And when you have, when you have situations, like, I mean, there was a Shays Rebellion where the Federal Army had to be called out at the very inception of the Republic, there was a John Brown incident that essentially led to the Civil War. So I don't want to suggest that what we're seeing now is unprecedented, because clearly it's not unprecedented, but it is dangerous. I mean, it is 1960, it's approaching 1960s levels of danger. I don't know that it's approaching, you know, 1850s levels of danger, just because the issues that undergird the Republic are not nearly as divisive and deep. I mean, what that's the thing that's so crazy about this. What the hell are we arguing about? Transgender bathrooms? Like we're gonna go shoot each other because Caitlyn Jenner wants to go to bathroom in a woman's bathroom, which, by the way, I oppose, but I'm not really willing to pick up a gun on that particular basis. I mean, like, there are severe and deep issues in the Republic. I think one of them is the infringements on religious freedom that the secular left is attempting to impose via the club of government. But I mean, that's what, when you look at the 60s, which you have literal race riots because Jim Crow is just being ended, and because we're in the middle of the Vietnam War, the most controversial war in American history. And if you look at the 1850s, when we're literally dealing with the specter of slavery expanding out to future states, and then you look at the issues that we have now, where we are currently talking about marginal tax rates and whether or not we ought to turn Medicaid into a block grant. Like, what? Like, just what? it's sort of like America's become a faculty lounge. It's all these you know, very rabid people arguing passionately with each other over the smallest and stupidest things that ever were.
Right. And that brings up a good point, and kind of segue into another topic I wanted to go over, and you kind of alluded to it several times. The insanity of, you know, a Shakespeare in the Park play, you know, and anybody who's read Shakespeare knows there's been modern day interpretations of those plays. I mean, they do it all the time. You know, does anybody, if you've ever seen Romeo and Juliet with Leonardo DiCaprio, I mean, that's not exactly how it happened when he wrote it. But I mean, obviously it touched a nerve with the Julius Caesar character kind of representing Donald Trump. But the whole idea was, it's like, this guy wasn't killed at the end of the play. He was killed in the middle of the play. And there was all of the ramifications that came as a result of that killing.
Yeah, but the play is mostly about how political assassination doesn't work out the way you want it to.
Exactly. It's perfect. And yet people started interrupting this, and then people were so-called, and I call them so-called conservatives, I'm sorry, because I don't find them to be, I don't see any leadership there. And Ben, I wanted what you thought about this, and I know you have strong feelings about it. Where are these, what happened? I mean, what, you know, I still watch episodes of Firing Line. And now we're supposed to be celebrating interrupting a play.
Yeah, it's idiotic. And not only is it idiotic, it's, again, tribal reactionary crap. So I'm trying to figure out exactly what the logic is that this is a good thing. So I guess there's the left logic, which is words are violence. This is violence against Trump. This is sort of the logic that was being used by a couple of the people who are going on TV talking about this, who associate with the alt-right but say they aren't alt-right themselves, which is fine. They're certainly not conservative. I mean, they have no idea what constitutional protections for free speech mean or what free speech principles mean. So there's a group of people who basically say any sort of play that depicts violence against the president is not only unacceptable, it must be shut down. Okay, that's a bunch of horse crap, and that stuff can be turned against anyone. It can be turned against me. It can be turned against Charles Murray. It can be turned against Ayaan Hirsi Ali. It can be turned against Heather McDonald. It's exactly that thing. And so I hate that. I think it's stupid. I think it's dumb and horrible when the left does it. I think it's even dumber and more horrible when the right does it. We're the ones who are supposed to be the good guys, right? I'm so sick of this idiotic logic that the right has now used. Well, the left does it. Right. Well, that's why they're bad, right? I mean, I'm on the right. I thought the idea here was that we get to wear the white hat in this particular cowboy play. So that was one logic. The other logic was the idea that we're going to use their tactics against them. We're going to show them that it's bad to protest plays or shut down college speakers by protesting plays. That would at least be mildly arguable, I suppose, if they actually used that logic. But they're not using that logic. They're not going out there and saying it's wrong to shut down plays. We want to show the left how wrong it is to do this. So we went and shut down a play. Number one, the left isn't shutting down plays. If you wanted to do this, you'd go shut down a speaker at a college campus and demonstrate that the heckler's veto can be utilized by either side, so it's bad. So that's really dumb. And finally, the real issue here is not that the people who produced Shakespeare in the Park are calling for the assassination of President Trump. It's that they are, as John Nolte, who disagrees with me really strongly on this issue, but Nolte has a great phrase, they are bubble stupid, right? The people who produced this play thought there would be not a lot of controversy at all, because a bunch of New Yorkers who don't like Trump, wouldn't it be cute, ha ha, wink, wink, nod, nod, the same exact way that Kathy Griffin was super taken aback by the fact that people were perturbed that she chopped off a mannequin Trump's head and then held it up all bloody. She was actually, like, she didn't expect any reaction because in the circles in which she runs, this is cute and funny. So, you know, it says more about the left than it does about the right, except that the right then embraces the same fascistic tactics that the left uses because, hey, well, they're doing it, and hey, well, they're being mean to Trump, and can you imagine if somebody had done this to Obama? Well, okay, first of all, I opposed it when the left did this, okay? Do you guys remember back in 2013, there was this idiotic thing where a rodeo clown in Missouri wore an Obama mask and said something like, the bull was going to come get him. And the Obama administration, I think they sent the DOJ down there, and the lieutenant governor condemned it, and a senator condemned it, as Claire McCaskill condemned it, and it became a whole national issue. And I remember sitting there at the time going, what the hell? What in fresh hell is this? What kind of stupidity is this? And now you have the right doing the exact same thing. And so I'm wondering at what point the right is different from the left if we're going to imitate their tactics. And then not only imitate their tactics, but the original logic was, okay, we'll imitate the tactics of the left so we can win. First of all, the left's tactics are causing them to lose every race they run across the country. Okay, they are losing on all these issues. They're not winning because they're jerks. They're losing because they're jerks. And then even if you assume that these tactics are winning tactics, the idea here, I guess, was you can put your morality aside for the higher goal of preserving right-wing politics. Okay, so then where are you pushing President Trump on enshrining Obama's executive amnesty? Where are you on the wall that hasn't been built? Where are you on Obamacare repeal that's not a repeal? Like, why is it that all that goes in the backseat? And it seems that all you're interested in, for a lot of people, is Trump tweeting nasty things about Democrats so that you can chortle. Like, I understand it's funny and all, but I don't understand why it exactly forwards the conservative agenda when you own all of the branches of government and aren't getting anything done.
Right, and that also brings me, you know, like, to the Seth Rich conspiracy that people like Sean Hannity are promoting. It's not just limited to these jokers who find their, you know, livelihood on social media. Yeah, but Sean Hannity has a big audience. And then here he is putting forward this theory that, you know, the Democratic National Committee had this staffer killed because he was the one that leaked the documents to, the DNC emails to WikiLeaks. And despite appeals from his parents to say, you know, this is not what happened, stop doing this, it didn't matter. And that kind of ugliness is something that, you know, it drives me crazy because for the longest time, Sean Hannity, of course, was like the basic, you know, he was your basic, you know, Republican who would basically say, okay, yeah, this is, you know, this is a Republican issue and I'm going to support it and everything. And now we're into Seth Rich conspiracies, and he's inviting this Kim guy from Kim.com who's like hiding out from authorities here in New Zealand and offering him his show and offering Julian Assange to be on his radio show. You know, where has it gone wrong?
I mean, I think that, again, it's just going back to the original point, tribalism, tribalism, tribalism. And I think that Trump is not the driver of this, but he is certainly a symptom and a driver of this. I think that the right was so trolled into oblivion by Obama that they began engaging in some of the same conspiracism that the left engaged in under Bush. I mean, it was the left that was saying that 9/11 was an inside job under Bush. And then you have Donald Trump who's promoting, I mean, he got famous in politics in the last 7 years by promoting the idiotic conspiracy theory that Barack Obama was born in Kenya. And then he won the presidency on the
right,
back of that.
Right.
You know, so it's hard for me to say that Sean isn't reflecting the Republican Party when the head of the Republican Party is a guy who believes that vaccines cause autism, that listens to Alex Jones and said that Barack Obama was born in Kenya and refuses to this day to say for certain that Barack Obama was not born in Kenya unless he is forced to on national television for 5 seconds. So, yeah, it's I can't read Sean. I'm upset about it because I think Sean is a good guy. He's always been very nice to me. I don't understand what's going on there. All I can say is that the only reason the Seth Rich story was being pushed was because it was a very bad week for President Trump that week, and Republicans needed a distraction, so they latched onto this local Fox story that ended up being debunked within 24 hours about a private investigation and Seth Rich and all this stuff. And so people leapt on that in order to create a counter narrative in spite of the pleas of the family, which is really quite disgusting. Again, one of the things that I've discovered in the last 2 years is that I thought I was deeply cynical about politics. I mean, I've been doing it my entire adult life. I thought I was cynical about politics. And every time I feel that I've reached bottom level cynicism, I look down and I realize there are 7 more floors below me. And it's almost every week. I mean, it's like every week I look around and I go, how much more cynical do I need to get to understand this? And then, I guess I better, start drinking acid because I have to get a lot more cynical. This is pretty wild.
So Ben, I want to turn the conversation to possible antidotes to this predicament here. And the one that I keep coming back to is I wonder if we have forgotten how to listen, how to actually listen to what the other person across from us is saying. And I wonder if that goes, that hits both sides. Are we trying to find common ground? Are we trying to understand them? Is that something that we can recapture? And if so, how? I want to circle back really quickly to something you said in an earlier comment about, we're supposed to be the good guys wearing white hat, that sort of thing. Well, from the left's perspective, they're supposed to be the good guys and they're supposed to be wearing white hats. And I've seen, some people on the left who have said, this isn't how we should be discussing stuff like this. I think that in order to listen, you first have to have some self-awareness. And so I wonder if we're lacking in self-awareness, and if we can just achieve some self-awareness, maybe we can work on listening.
I mean, I hope so. I think there are two ways that the country can be healed, at least to the extent where we can live with one another again without this kind of nonsense every day. I think number one is, the most optimistic vision, which is we reestablish that we are indeed seeking the same ends. I don't think that's actually true in politics right now. I don't think the left wants the same America that the right wants. I think the left wants a secularist America with a lot more redistribution, a lot more restrictive view of property rights. I don't think that back in the 50s, I think there was a pretty solid consensus on what people wanted America to look like. I don't think that that's the case now. I think even, despite all the racial problems, we were moving beyond those and we were getting past that, thank God, and the problems of sexism. But I think that Americans, broadly speaking, had the same basic vision for what they wanted their lives to look like in the United States. Build a family, take care of your family, have a good job, have a community, go to church. I don't think that that's the same thing now. And I do think that that's a serious problem that's been created by two generations of, leftist social engineering. I don't know that that's going to be bridgeable. I think the first step to bridging any of this is both sides are going to need to forswear tactics that are just disgusting. We don't have to agree on ends, at least for now. But if we can't agree on which means are out of line, then we're not even going to be able to live together. And we can live together and disagree wildly on this stuff and get angry over politics. But if we don't agree that we're not allowed to punch each other, or we don't agree that we're not allowed to disrupt each other's events, or we don't agree
or
that we're not allowed to
shoot congressmen, that sort of thing.
Shoot congressmen. I mean, yeah, exactly. If we can't agree on this sort of basic stuff, we're not even moral human beings. And then we really ought to go to war. I mean, if we're going to act with this sort of wartime morality, then at least let's be honest enough to have the guts to man up. I mean, if all these keyboard warriors keep declaring civil war, well, at a certain point, why don't you actually just go do it? I mean, this is your point earlier, and everybody knows that it's BS, which is why they're not doing it. So, I think that would be a good place to start. I think it would also be a good place to start to actually try to read outside of your preferred viewpoint. So, right now, I think that social media is a wonderful thing. I love Facebook. I love Twitter, obviously. But people tend to follow people they like on Twitter. People tend to follow people they like on Facebook. And so if you like an article from Daily Wire, you're probably going to get one from Daily Caller. If you like one from Huffington Post, you're probably going to get one from Think Progress or TPM right after that. If you listen to my podcast, then you're probably going to not listen to Pod Save America. I think it'd be worthwhile for people to make an overt effort to try and listen to one podcast from the other side. Listen to Fifth Estate if you're on the left, and see if it's something with which you agree, or listen to my show and see if it's something with which you agree, or if you find me completely unreasonable, and if so, why? I've had the privilege of growing up in L.A., so I've spent my entire life around people who are of the left. I went to Harvard Law School, so I spent my entire legal education hanging out with people who disagreed with me. I debated routinely with Lonnie Guinier, back when President Clinton was president. He tried to appoint her Secretary of Labor, and the Democratic Senate rejected her because she was too far left. She and I got along famously, even though we disagreed on everything, because the discussions were interesting and they went to central principles. If you've never met anybody who disagrees with you, then you're doing America wrong, I think.
Well, Ben, we're going to isolate that audio where you told people to listen to our podcast, I think.
Go for it.
Well, Ben, our time is pretty much an end here. We appreciate you joining us. It was a great discussion.
Oh, thanks so much. And just one further note, one last note here.
Sure.
One of the things that's been super puzzling for me over the last couple of years is that I'm uber right wing, like uber libertarian, uber right wing. And yet there's this bizarre feeling among a lot of people that I'm suddenly moderate. And that is entirely due. If you think I'm a moderate, again, I would suggest that it is because you are not looking at the principles about which I am speaking. You are more looking about, you're more looking at allegiances to particular political figures, which is an issue about which I care nothing.
Oh, I'm sure. You know, I've been called a libtard because I'm not, you know, on the Trump train. So that, you know, and if anybody who knows me for more than a half an hour knows that I'm not a liberal. So
it's just, so ridiculous. It's, I mean, if you're in the pathetic clinging by a lot of people who are on the Trump train to the never Trump myth, as though there are a bunch of people out here who are rooting for Trump to fail and rooting for Ossoff to win in Georgia 6th. No one is never Trump. Okay, never Trump ended the day of the election when people didn't vote for him. Okay, right. I didn't vote for either candidate. That was my decision. And after Trump won, I was very happy Hillary wasn't in office. And now I am sometimes Trump. When he does good things, then I am then I am for him. And when he does bad things, I am against him. But I was sometimes Obama too. It was just that sometimes Obama ended up being never Obama because he was always wrong. So how about this? I hold Trump to the same exact standard. If he does a lot of things that I like, then I will be pro-Trump. If he does a lot of things I don't, then I will be anti-Trump because I care about the conservatism, not the guy with the funny hair. Come on.
That's true. All right. Well, Ben, before we let you go, we do have one last question we do have to ask.
Yes, we do. It's our one gotcha that we spring on our guests, and we recently changed it up. So this is a fresh one, and you know, we the first result did not go my way. I want to tell you up front, Ben, there's a right and a wrong answer to this, and it matters. What you say
okay.
here, it matters. So let's get this one going. Ben Shapiro, which is better, the Beatles or the Rolling Stones?
I mean, you're asking the wrong dude. I don't listen to anything by anyone beyond like 1950. So, I would say the Beatles were able to write catchier melodies than the Rolling Stones. I hate what the Beatles did to culture, though. I did two. The end of my podcast for the last 2 days was about how much I hate the Beatles in terms of what they did for the culture. So I will say musically the Beatles. I will say culturally the Rolling Stones, because I think the Beatles did more damage to the culture with all the inculcation of the drug culture into Britain and the United States.
All right.
So that's a difficult one to score. I'm inclined to give myself the point on that one.
You hear what I'm playing, Neil? So I play the Rolling Stones.
Thank you, Jay.
Yes, Ben, I'm giving you that one.
Final note on that. I'll take Mozart and Beethoven and Bach over. I'm a classical violinist. I was classically trained as a violinist for 15 years. So, I used to play competitions and everything. So, I'll take all the classical composers over any of them. And all the people who compare the Beatles to Beethoven, the Beatles couldn't read music. Okay, you don't get to compare them to Beethoven when they couldn't read music. All right.
There you go, Neil. He's getting shots on the Beatles.
Once you get me going on this, okay. Also, I do have to get one quick demerit for the Beatles, and I was glad to hear that Yoko Ono was involved in the writing of Imagine. Imagine is legitimately the worst song that was ever written, so I can't credit that to the Beatles because it was just Lennon, but it is legitimately the most abominable piece of art that has ever been placed on
it,
the planet.
It
includes everything up to and including Bieber.
It is a terrible song. As much as I can't understand why people laud it so much, it's a, if you really read the lyrics, it's such a horrible song. So I'm going to give you that one. So all right.
Yes.
Well, there you
Stones.
Go, Neil.
Thank you, Ben.
Ben,
okay,
thanks again
guys.
For joining us. Appreciate it. Make sure you guys read the Daily Wire. Follow Ben on Twitter at Ben Shapiro. And anyway, so there you go, Neil. You got to win.
It had to happen eventually.
Yeah, had to happen. Well, maybe one time we'll choose you know, classical things, and we'll see what kind of tribalism exists between those who Beethoven versus Mozart. You know. All right, everyone. Well, that's going to do it for this episode of The Fifth Estate. As we always say, make sure you go out there, go to iTunes, leave us a rating, leave us a review, tell your friends to subscribe. We appreciate it. It's great. It's always fun. Neil loves it. I love it. And that's going to do it. We will see you next time here on The Fifth Estate. We'll